Osiris.
We're live. Brian and I are here talking business, and we're going live. Brian did some extra work on the show over the weekend, and I'm very appreciative, Brian. How are you?
I'm great, man. I'm good. I'm doing all right. It's Tuesday, July 5th. I listened to a lot of Dave Matthews. I've talked about a lot of Dave Matthews.
Yeah.
My wife is singing a lot of Dave Matthews. My son is requesting more Dave Matthews. My whole house, my whole life, everything has changed in the last 10 days. It's absolutely wild.
It's true. It is an all-encompassing thing.
It really is. This little show that we're doing, you know, this is our fourth episode, which for most podcasts usually takes you a couple weeks, maybe a month or so to get to that point. We're four episodes in, 1 week in. We're learning on the fly. We're figuring this thing out. It's called The Live Show because it's about live albums. It's about live releases within a band's larger catalog. But it's also The Live Show because it infringes on our lives in a lot of ways. It affects our lives in big ways, in ways that I don't even know if we're prepared for, and we're here for it. RJ, you've had a pretty wild, pretty good, pretty wild. I actually don't know the context, so I don't know how to even introduce this, but tell us about your morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. So I'm here at the beach until tomorrow. And this morning, if you have kids, you'll appreciate this story. And if you don't have kids, maybe it'll help you. But decided this morning that I would take my kids to the arcade in downtown Stone Harbor. So, you know, put
good
like
summer activity
morning, you know, put $10 on everyone's little cards and everyone's running around like playing games and, you know, having fun. And then we get to the part where we are like checking out and you use your tickets to get like prizes. Right. So my older daughter, the whole time she was playing to get prizes. She knew exactly what the game was. She was like,
she's old enough to know, like, there's got to be a reward here.
I'm going to accumulate as many tickets as possible. And then she got like some crappy sunglasses and like two other crappy plastic things. And our twins, who are 5 and a half, they basically didn't have enough tickets to get anything. And it was like 11:45. I had to get home to do this. And they're like, I want that, that, and that. And I'm like, there's not enough tickets, and I'm not going to spend like $30 to buy you like a plastic toy. And it ended with my wife picking us up and me basically dragging them out of the arcade crying while my older daughter had like her sunglasses on and like was just like loving life. And we get in the car and they're just like bawling. And I'm like, wow, that was what a disaster.
The amount of emotions that we shed on both ends of the spectrum here, you know, like the pride that your older daughter has of having sunglasses and the fury and anger and sadness that your twins have over entirely cheap Chinese plastic.
Yep.
It's an amazing thing. Cause I remember feeling this as a kid. I remember being like, I got to get like 250 tokens to get that like little like monster that goes on your finger. Like I'm going to beat every single game. And then you get it and like you lose it in 3 days.
Yeah. And then it's over. I mean, it's ridiculous.
It's amazing with how much has changed in America that there still are arcades that are literally just scams for parents' money.
Yep.
And it's just a time suck for kids. It's an incredible summer activity.
It's amazing. And, you know, it was crowded and like getting the cards loaded up with money in the first place. Anyway, that's not what we're here to discuss today, but we are going to discuss a lot of other important life issues. But first, I do want to say we have a couple things going on. First of all, if you are a Dead & Company or Grateful Dead fan and you live in the Philly area, or if you're interested in going to see Dead & Company at Citizens Bank Park, that's next Sunday. We're doing a ticket giveaway through Osiris Social. The game is you have to put in a submission about the Philly Fanatics' favorite Grateful Dead song. And we will be choosing a few people at random to win two tickets to see Dead & Company. And if you want to get tickets, you can go to osirispod.com/Philly. Another thing that we want to talk about. So in 2 weeks, on the 18th of July, we're going to be hosting a live event at the Ardmore Music Hall. And we have three amazing guitarists and a house band that we're going to interview the guitarists, and then they're going to play a bunch of music for us. Chris Forsythe, Tom Hamilton, Daniel Donato. It's going to be a lot of fun. We can tell you that if you go to osirispod.com/osirislive, you can get tickets for the Ardmore show. And I think that's it. Those are my announcements for now, but we'd love to see you at Philly Dead & Company, at Ardmore. We'd like to see you everywhere. So I just want to say that. What do you got, Brian?
We would love to see you there. I would say as well, we announced last Thursday an Osiris Live event that is going to be taking place the night before the Dick's Run out here in Denver. We have Taper's Choice, an incredible collection of artists and musicians that have come together. Dave Harrington, Chris Thompson, Alex Bleeker, most notably, have come together in the last 8-9 months and have played a collection of shows, and they've written some really wild songs. Their jams are super inventive. Dave Harrington, if you know anything about me as a listener, is one of my top five favorite guitarists currently making music. Chris Thompson plays drums in Vampire Weekend. Alex Bleeker is the bassist in Real Estate. It's really cool musical backgrounds to come together to play a bunch of great jams. And we're going to have them at the Larimer Lounge in Denver. We're going to sit down and do a quick interview with them, and then they're going to play a set of music. It'll be their first shows in Denver. And these guys have been killing it in New York City and LA and up and down the California coast. Read that link for me one more time, RJ, because we are live from ticket sales, I think through the same similar link as what you have.
Yeah. osirispod.com/OsirisLive.
Perfect. And those will be going on sale. Those are $15 leading up to the show day. So I'm really stoked about that. We're going to have a couple people from Osiris here for that. It should be awesome. And we've got a couple other things in the works. There's more to come. This is the summer of Osiris. I'm very, very excited.
It's true. He's right. He's right, everybody. So speaking of the summer, because this show wasn't during the summer, but we're going to go back to almost summer, 1996.
Richmond in April has to be summer. I want to say one thing really, really quickly. Just one thing. If you listen to this show on the podcast, you heard the debut of the theme song of the live show. I want to give a shout out to our good friend, our musical inspiration, Mr. Amar Sastry. He comes up with pretty much everything that we use here on the within the Osiris universe. He's an amazing songwriter. He takes whatever abstract ideas we have and says, hey, here's a theme song for you. And then we use it. It's great. It's killer. It's awesome. So thank you, shout Amar. Out to Amar. But yeah, let's get to 4/30/1996. This is the earliest show that we've talked about here in the D&B catalog. Yeah.
And so we're talking about Richmond, Virginia, and Brian, I think, can give us a little bit of context, because in here you can hear them sort of like Dave mentions a few times that they're just getting back to playing shows. They took a break for a while. They have some new material. We're gonna get into it. But Brian, tell us about where this show takes place. Anything we need to know?
So the show takes place at the Classic Amphitheater in Richmond, Virginia, which is kind of an interesting amphitheater. It opened in 91. It was the only Virginia area amphitheater for a number of years. So it attracts a lot of artists that are coming through the East Coast. They're playing in Virginia. It becomes kind of this beacon of live music. But it had three main issues. It had zero boxes for sponsors or any sort of like important VIP folks that are coming to shows that fund these sorts of events through box office purchases. It had a very small lawn, where a lot of amphitheaters are built with a smaller pavilion and a big lawn, so you can kind of pack people in at a lower rate for tickets. This had a kind of the reverse issue, so people were paying a premium to sit in the pavilion. Not as many people could get on the lawn. And one of the issues that plagues a certain number of venues around the country, and I really don't understand how there's not a workaround for this, but they had an area where you could buy and drink beer, and you could not bring beer into the venue, which just seems to like shoot venues in the foot almost from the gate, like from the jump. Like how as a concert goer, you want to buy that beer, come back to your seat, enjoy that beer, enjoy some music, and then go back and enjoy some shows. So, or buy another beer at that point in time.
Yeah. Yeah. Jones Beach is like that.
Is it?
Because it's like a national park or state park or something.
That's got to be the issue.
It's not great.
It's not great. I think the Gorge has that issue up on like the lawn area. SPAC, for whatever reason, does not have that issue, even though that's on the state park. But as a result of it, the venue kind of falls off in the second half of the 1990s. Other venues open throughout Virginia. It books one act in 1991, kind of the brethren of the Dave Matthews Band in many ways, Hootie and the Blowfish, before they all went off into very different directions. It's kind of seen some reinvestment and was making a comeback pre-COVID. So it's a small theater in Richmond, Virginia, that Dave Matthews would play 3 years in a row here. This was their second time playing at the Classic Amphitheater in Virginia. Kind of their second home. It's like they grew up in Charlottesville. Richmond's right down the road. Go to Richmond and have a little bit more of a larger market. So that's where we are at this point in time for this show.
At one point early in the show, Dave says, "We have a new CD out. We hope you all got to check out our new CD," which just reminds me, you know, we keep going back and forth between the ages. For some reason, I'm interested always in talking about like what's happening in music at this point, and not just technology. Like, you know, we're pre-streaming. He said we just made a new CD. We hope you guys like it, and if it sucks, play it a few more times, which is a funny thing. And we'll hear a bunch of songs that were new then, which, you know, end up being classics for them. But what else was happening in 96? I mean, we can talk about the bands that we like, you know, what they were doing in 96, but is there anything more broadly we need to know about the spring of 1996?
So on this day, Howard Stern's radio show debuts. In addition to this.
No shit. At his first one?
I don't know if it's his first one, but I think it was his most recent prior to Sirius XM that had debuted at that point in time in Massachusetts. From a Billboard chart standpoint, it's kind of wild. Three divas are dominating. We've got Mariah Carey's Always Be My Baby, Celine Dion's Because You Love Me, which came from a really just like sappy movie with, I think, Robert Redford and Michelle Pfeiffer from like the mid-90s. And then I don't know if you necessarily can call her a diva, but like I just threw it in. Alanis Morissette's Ironic is in the top five at this point
in
time.
All right.
Which Jagged Little Pill is like the biggest album in America at this point, which really puts this in context. Like this is 1996 America. I have memory of buying two CDs during this era. You want to hear what those two CDs were?
I do.
This is the era where you have to buy a CD because you like a single. But like,
yep.
I'm coming out of fifth grade at this point in time. So like, this is what I was listening to for some reason. Duncan Sheik put out a single called Barely Breathing that apparently really connected with me as like an 11-year-old kid. And the Verve Pipes put out the song The Freshman, which is... that's a classic song. It holds up. It's really relevant nowadays. And the album doesn't totally, but you know, I loved that song.
Okay. The Verve as in the same Verve that did Bittersweet Symphony?
Different. This is the Verve Pipe.
The Verve. Not even real.
I think they have like two albums, but this was their first. And this was a song I really connected with. My mom drove me to Best Buy and she was like, "Why are we buying this album?" I played it on the way home. She was like, "I don't really like this music." But she, you know, I made money lawn mowing and I bought some records.
That's awesome. I'm proud of you for buying music at that age. Most people were not. But we know that people who follow music closely and end up loving music get started early.
CDs.
I don't, for people listening to the podcast, this is going to seem like a slight diversion, but and I just have to take the bait on this comment from you, John, who says, "RJ, I love you." And thank you, John. I love you too. But Goose is a pop band? Saw them at Peach and they blew my mind, but pop? Interesting. I don't think they will be on pop radio. So here's one thing. I saw that Slow Ready, one of the songs from their new album, Goose's new album, is at the top of Spotify's ultimate indie playlist right now, which is a huge, huge thing for them. So they're already, I mean, that doesn't really answer your question, John, but or address your comment, but they're already getting indie love. And I think like a song like Slow Ready, it's got catchy lyrics, it's got a hook, it's in the album version is designed for, you know, people who like to listen to 4 or 5 minute songs, and it's an earworm like a lot of their songs. And to me, like, that's the definition of pop. You know, they're writing verse, chorus, verse, bridge, chorus. Like, they're doing that, and they're doing it uniquely and differently. And the fact that they're getting love from like the indie community, I think, pushes it further toward pop. But pop radio, it's a good point. Like, they won't be on, you won't hear, like, you know, I don't know, Cardi B and an old Britney Spears song and then Goose on pop radio. I just mean pop in terms of the way they construct their songs and the way they tap into different influences, including a lot of the lyrical kind of like the auto tune and the stuff they're doing with the vocal arrangements on a lot of these songs. So I guess that's my explanation, but probably not on pop radio in a classic sense, John. So thank you for the comment. Although we might be here to talk about Goose someday on this show, but we probably should get back to Dave Matthews just so people don't ditch us, unless you want to respond to that.
Well, I think it's a really interesting point based on this specific episode, because I was listening to this show. This is the crash release party, as you were hinting at earlier. And it's really wild to listen to this concert in conjunction with Live Track 7, which we will be talking about next Tuesday, which is the 12/31/1996 show, the year finale. And there's a moment in that show where Dave talks about, like, I think it's right before, I haven't listened to that album yet for this series, but I've listened to it in the past. I think there's a moment right before they play Crash Into Me where Dave talks about, like, this has been a huge year for us. And I think it's really interesting to talk about, and it's fascinating that we've got like Goose fans invading this specific podcast. Like, it's amazing to me, because where Goose is right now and where they're at with Drip Field being released and with songs hitting like high up on the Spotify charts, and there's a lot of interest beyond the jam band community around Goose, Dave Matthews is dealing with that exact same thing with Crash. Crash is a really accessible, but really interesting album. There's a lot of layers to that record. There's a lot of really cool moments. Number 41, Say Goodbye. There's a lot of like cool production choices that Steve Lillywhite, who's putting this record out with Dave Matthews Band and is going to put Billy Breathes out with Fish 6 months later, is doing. Like, there's an argument to be made that Crash, Billy Breathes, Before These Crowded Streets, and now Drip Field are like in this lineage of some of the best work that jam band artists post 70s Grateful Dead could do in a studio.
And I just want to take a moment to acknowledge that segue from Brian. I mean, that was just, you couldn't have scripted that. So thank you, Brian, for bringing us. It's a really good point. I hadn't actually thought about that, but that's a really, it's a great point. And thank you for articulating that, but keep going if you have more.
Well, I just think like to kind of close the loop, and I appreciate that. That's a nice tip. And thank you everyone for coming to the potential future Goose live podcast. Well, I'm wearing my TED hat. This was not planned today, but shout out. I bought this a year ago before Drip Field came out. All right. I was in on it before. But I think there's a really interesting place. I was actually talking with one of our close friends and our colleague about where Goose is going. And I think there's a really interesting couple of paths for them. And if you look at Dave Matthews from here in 1996 to where we saw them last week in 98, 04, and 2000, of is this band going to kind of be glommed onto by the larger industry and kind of pushed towards pop success, or are they going to retain this kind of experimental side? Because they have both of it going for them really, really well right now. And where Dave Matthews is in 1996, I don't know if it's directly comparable to where Goose is at right now, because the music industry is just so different. And I don't think that like Goose necessarily has a crash into me on Drip Field, but there is that push and pull of experimentation or mainstream success that Goose is facing in a way that I don't really think any jam band faced since Dave Matthews Band.
That is great. And I think a lot of the people who are commenting agree. I think it's interesting that, and Concert Vids, I think Crash 96 and Drip Field 22 and the years they drop are very linear. It's really interesting. This will be our last thing. Concert Vids said earlier, this is something that I'm seeing a lot from friends, like indie friends who don't like jam bands. I have a neighbor whose wife, like we went to Mexico with her and she tolerates Phish, I guess, but she like is like obsessed with Goose. Not like I like going to the show. She's like, it's all she listens to now. I just think that's interesting that there are people who are being brought into this, I don't know, environment or whatever without really any connection to other jam bands. So, okay. Should we talk about this show? This is a very interesting topic, but I like it. What else do you have before we go into it? Because I think that now we know that the release of Crash and the release of Drip Field are connected cosmically, linearly, and as Brett Wooden said, Dave is a huge inspiration to Rick, so it ties in. So I think we're there.
I think that we hear the crossover there and the opportunity. So I have a couple thoughts about this show before, like as we're jumping into it. Like I think we can kind of set the table and jump into the show. But I'm curious, like I want to ask you, like we did three shows last week. We were in a 98 show and a 2000 show that I think we both agreed were fascinating. Like that to me, that 98 show was like, that is my zone so far for Dave Matthews Band. And the 2000 show, I thought from a set listing standpoint, from a playing standpoint, was outstanding. The 2004 show was totally new territory for me. I thought it was really interesting. This is the classic period for Dave Matthews Band. So I'm curious, after a week of doing this, of kind of for both of us dipping our toes into areas that we hadn't necessarily spent much time in from a Dave standpoint, what were your thoughts on going back now to like Dave playing that very thin guitar, like way up high, like pajama pants with dress shoes, like the band like is not decked out in like linen shirts, like they look like a ragged college band still if you look at pictures from 96. Like what were your thoughts going back to this, and how did that like inform your listen going into it?
I think it's like a much, in terms of the sound, like it's a much simpler and more like stripped down sound you get from the band in 96. It does sound a little bit more like a college band. I guess the one thing that I read on antsmarching.org, in addition to hearing many new songs for the first time, fans in attendance were the first to hear the new sound system that DMB had recently inherited from the Grateful Dead. It helped take DMB's live show experience to the next level. I just think that's interesting because I thought this sounded more like a, it sounded like a lot thinner, like you said. Maybe they were still... they were still kind of like, you know, they obviously had just started using the sound system. And a lot of the songs are not, they're just simpler, you know, especially the ones that were new at this time that we would then hear jammed out in lots of different future formats. But you have a lot of like 5 to 6 minute songs, which I think as DMB moves on, you get more of the 10 to 12 or even longer. There's one in here that's longer, which we'll talk about. But I think it's a much, much simpler sound. Dave's voice is interesting. I didn't really anticipate that Dave's voice would be like different back then.
Yeah.
It's like more, it's less polished, I think. Like his singing is less polished, but it's also like really like on Say Goodbye is like the screaming and the really like very authentic and awesome. Whereas I think later he gets a little more polished with his voice. So I guess that was mostly like less polished, but really kind of raw and emotional in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I'm in agreement with you on all of that. Like I think the the Grateful Dead lineage is really fascinating. And, you know, we'll talk about this a bit in tomorrow's episode, but like this era, they're still feeling to me like they're a part of the Grateful Dead lineage in a lot of cases, in a way that like they strike me as a band that kind of broke out of that and became more of a pop act, and then like kind of retained that jam band legacy. But, you know, 95, Dave plays one of my favorite Grateful Dead covers of all time. His performance of Eyes of the World a few days after Jerry's passing is just an absolutely stunning performance, and it always blows me away. But like to have them inherit the Grateful Dead sound system, it feels kind of like we talk in summer 2022 of torches being passed. It feels like a nod of like, hey, you guys are doing something that we really approve of, and you know, here's you guys take on the sound system that worked for us. It's interesting to me. I'm going to make a very bold claim right now, as we're getting into this. I think, as someone who I would say like I have a decent understanding of Dave Matthews Band's evolution through Busted Stuff, and then from there I'm totally, you know, just to clarify again, totally learning on the fly, but I think their peak was 98 to 2000 in a lot of cases. And this to me sounds like, if you want to make like an athlete comparison, like this sounds like the year before the leap, where like you start to hear the hints, you start to see what's happening as this band is both tightening things up, but also as this band is, you know, kind of putting themselves in a position where they're taking a lot of risks, where they're taking a lot of challenge. They're starting to take risks on stage, but they've recorded this really solid album. They're playing this album out as much as possible, and they're taking this energy that has really worked in a bar theater standpoint, and they're starting to blow it out to amphitheaters. And within a year, they're going to be at a totally different level. But where I hear this band is kind of like taking that step at this point in time.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. And let's talk about the tracks a little bit. I mean, I mentioned the Say Goodbye, particularly Dave's singing, but Two Step, Say Goodbye, and then this Richmond Jam, which as named by the band. And it was just sort of like Dave kind of riffing on being in Richmond and playing music. That's what I took away from that. Is there anything else to it that I missed?
No, I think it's pretty straightforward in that standpoint. I think it's really interesting. I think it's an interesting kind of like diversion early on in the show. You know, I think ultimately the thing that's most notable to me is like you get 11 of the 12 tracks from Crash here. So those really define the set list. And to still have a moment where the band goes from Say Goodbye into a jam with, you know, some kind of scattered lyrics, it shows like what I was just saying, like the risk taking is there, even though like they're playing pretty straight and trying to like nail these songs live.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a bunch of stuff that comes in pretty early on. So Too Much, So Much to Say, Crash Into Me. It's really, I mean, good performances of these songs. And clearly a lot of these songs are new. But man, when I was listening to Crash Into Me, I mean, the song is just so powerful still to me, like 30 years after I first heard it. Like, is Dave one of the best ever at writing love songs? It's like almost,
I think, in this era he is.
He is, right? I mean, like every song is kind of, not every song, a lot of the songs are kind of love songs, but he's really good at writing them. They're not like straightforward in terms of being like too, I don't know, they're not like too sappy, they're not too like, I don't know, they're really pretty awesome songs. So that was one of my thoughts. But another thing that I saw here is there's number 41 is a newish song, and Dave actually talks about that being new. And first of all, it's like 7 minutes, which I think we've talked about before, even in some other versions of it, like from other years, are like, you know, 15 minutes or longer, and they end up being the jam of the show. And this is really like just a run through of this song. But I noticed in some of the early other live tracks that take place later on, we've talked about this a few times, but like everyone goes nuts when number 41 starts. And here you can kind of hear that it's, you can tell it's kind of a new song. It's like nobody really knows what's going on. And I guess I should, I was thinking about this while I was listening to number 41, just it's like, you know, the response was kind of muted and it clearly people were giving the new material a chance. And eventually they, a lot of these songs would turn out to be classics, but I've always been fascinated with how artists mix in new material with older songs. You know, some artists, like more mainstream artists, will just go and play a song, a show of all new songs, right?
Yeah.
And like, you know, some of the bands that, that we know and see a lot, I think they sprinkle in, I guess when you're more focused on the live show, as opposed to being like an album focused band, you can kind of like, you can just sprinkle in new material, but this is pretty heavy new material without, without really going overboard, I think. But I don't know. I'm curious about your thoughts on like the balance in the show between the new material and old material.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about that a lot because I think like four volumes into this, what has really blown me away and what has really been like the aspect of the band that I've been most interested in is kind of the surprise. Let's dip back into the recesses of our songwriting. Let's showcase a rarer song in a really prime slot in the show. Let's kind of blow out these songs like number 41, like Seek Up. And I was listening to this show and I enjoyed it, but I was kind of like, it feels like a very, very much of a run through of new songs, which makes sense based on the fact that this was the Crash release party. But it also, it made me wonder why this got a release, especially this early in the series. Like there's a couple notable things. We talked about the Grateful Dead sound system, which changes the dynamic of the band's overall playing. Obviously the Crash release party is a huge, huge moment, in the band's overall career. And as the, DMB Almanac states, the great thing about the show is that it catches the band at a really interesting point in their development. You can still hear the raw energy that the live show is known for, but also start to hear the polish of a veteran band that is completely comfortable in their surroundings. And I was thinking about all that with the dynamic of like this set list is something that if you're coming to this show, just kind of out of curious, you know, out of curiosity, you're being overwhelmed with a lot of new songs. And it made me wonder, like, I saw the majority of my Dave Matthews shows in 2001, which is coming off of this period we talked about in our last episode where they write all these incredible songs for the Lily White Sessions. And then there's this crash course with Glenn Ballard. They release every day. And so much of the summer 2001 shows are dominated by them trying to force feed these everyday songs into their set list and to, you know, this grand reception from their community where they'll play Angel for like 13 minutes. And it's really just kind of like a big blues song, but like, hey, we're going to like blow this out like we've blown out other songs. And I was thinking about this show, like, I think being in attendance, it had to be, these are all great songs. And these are all songs that are going to, for the most part, live in the Dave Matthews set list. But for me, listening 28 years later, 26 years later, I don't know, 26 years later, I think, I was like, this is a lot of Crash. And this is a lot of Crash played straight to the overall album. That as a live release, I don't know how much it's aside from like all the context that you learn, like, I don't know how much like I'd throw this release on just knowing that it's a ton of Crash in a very short amount of time. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I just put in a comment on the screen here about the, some of the Crash songs, like Too Much. I think this is probably like the 15th or 20th time they played Too Much, but So Much to Say it was being played since 92, and some of these songs had been played a lot before this. And maybe the previous comment, like, they were played more like the album versions in this show and shows around the time, which makes sense. I mean, I think the, like, number 41 and So Much to Say and Too Much, they all sound like pop songs at this point. They sounded like they were practicing them or had rehearsed them like for an album, you know. It's funny to interesting it's funny to hear these interesting songs like Number 41 and Lie in Our Graves that are in later years like big jam vehicles, big for like for DMB, and they're just sort of like tight versions that are much more focused on the song structure. I'd sort of like after the first three live tracks, I'd sort of gotten used to them stretching out a lot of these songs and this show, and maybe it's because it was an album release party. I'm not familiar enough with the rest of the 96 tour, but I will find out, you know, how much this is an anomaly and how much these were like just playing these songs through after the release of the album, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I'm pulling up, the 96 New Year's run, because there's the show obviously from 1231 that we're going to talk about, and that has some pretty significant jams on it. Now granted, that show has a ton of sit-ins from the entire Bela Fleck and the Flecktones band, but you've got a 14 minute Seek Up, Two Step by this point in time is almost 11 minutes, Number 41 stretches to 15 and a half, Typical Situation goes into a jam, but like, you know, you've got these songs that like are going to be played out in a way. And I think that, you know, we're on the cusp of them realizing, we're on the cusp of them realizing what the potential of a song like Number 41 is, which to me is like, we talked about this in episode one. That is my favorite Dave Matthews song. That is a song to me that like, it fuses everything that this band does so well, which is mix kind of dimly lit, kind of mercurial lyrics and storytelling that you can't totally figure out, that like could mean one thing to you and a totally different thing to me and a totally different thing to the songwriter. You may not even know what the song is about and it sounds fascinating, but then, you know, you've got Leroy Moore's sax really dominating it. You've got Stefan, you've got Carter connecting in ways that like really hold down this rhythmic section that allows the song to open up. And hearing it in this setting, as Tyler Hensley, you just had this comment on, it's a live track, so I very rarely, if ever, revisit. It kind of, to me, feels like a moment where the band is saying, hey, we have this new release series, let's put out a show that was really important to us but may not teach us a ton about the band, just on like a surface level listening.
Yeah. And the another comment here, just that most of the Number 41s without a guest in this year were 7 minutes, which makes sense. So what else, I mean, what other, go ahead.
I was gonna say, it's wild that like in 2 years that's a 20-minute song.
Yeah, you know? That's true. Yeah. I think the Jimmy thing is, you know, I think right before that he says we're going to play an old song now, and, you know, 15 minute jam, really cool, but like really, I don't want to say like basic jam, but I enjoyed it quite a bit. I thought it was really fun, but it was like, it was very, straightforward, you know, in a good way. I think that's just another thing with these shows in this time period, just like really kind of like raw sound, which I think is great. What were some of your highlights from the rest of this? Cause I think this show kind of like dips off a little bit after the Jimmy thing. And in typical fashion, there's like a, you know, 4-song encore, which is great. But what did you think of that sort of last quarter, I guess, like the Ants Marching, Proudest Monkey, Satellite, Cry Freedom, Drive In, Drive Out? They were kind of all back to back, and felt like the energy dipped a little bit, but curious about your thoughts.
I agree. And I'm trying to do this thing where when I listen to these shows, I don't look at the set list at all. Like you pull up on Nugs and you see the first 3 songs, and I'm trying to just like go into this as blind as possible to just get like as pure of an experience as I can. And by the time I kind of got to this last section, like we'll talk about it here in our awards segment, like I found my bathroom break finally, where I was like, okay, like I know where to go. But I thought Ants Marching is only 6 minutes and 40 seconds. That was one of my absolute highlights of the overall show. There's so much energy, and you can really hear the band at that point. You know, there had to be so much building up to this day when this album is released. They're in the studio with Lily White. You know, Steve Lily White at this point in time, he's 15 years past producing the first three U2 records, and he's done a ton of work throughout the late 80s and early 90s. Like, he's a really respectable name from a production standpoint. There's a lot of money behind this record. There's Crash Into Me, the song itself, that I'm sure once the label heard it was like, okay, that is being pushed to every radio station for the summer. There just had to be a ton of logistics in this. And for the band to then come out and play 11 of the 12 songs, there seems like a sigh of relief when they get to Ants Marching, because it's just, you know, it's one of the songs that broke them. But at this point, there's no pressure on Ants Marching anymore. They don't have to play it, but they love playing it. And it's got this infectious groove, and it's got this like connective piece for all members of the band to shine every single time they play it. The lyrics to Ants Marching are kind of like, they kind of summarize the global perspective of this band in terms of like what their message is, how they communicate themselves artistically to the world. And the latter section, where you get Boyd and Leroy and Carter kind of all going back and forth, it just like, I re-listened to it after, you know, the first time I was going through it, and it just really hit me. But what about you? What about, like, did you find that in Ants Marching? Did you find it any time later in the show?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, like, listening to these shows, I hear it mostly through Dave's voice, you know, like, he's, right? Like, you can tell when he's, and in all these live tracks, I mean, they're clearly, like, you know, important releases for the band for different reasons, or for Dave and the band. I think it's pretty cool at this point. They are kind of like out of this kind of, I mean, you can hear it in the crowd too. Like, they start to get a little more loose, and I think the crowd is more receptive to, like, once they start mixing in the older songs. So given that it was like an album release show, it's, you know, people knew what to expect, but it was a little bit of a release, I think. And the crowd starts to like get a little bit, you know, more into it at that point. Although, according to the show flow chart, there are many dips after this, but I think the Ants Marching was sort of a little bit of a peak in the show.
Yeah, we see some dips like you're talking about right after Ants Marching that kind of like dries. Like, there's some good moments, but like overall, I think song selection wise, it seemed like they were, at least from a listener standpoint, they were not selecting the most chosen songs from a Celestine standpoint. I think that's putting it nicely. There's two songs that dip way below zero at this point.
Well, what was your highlight of this part?
Honestly, I was really stoked to hear Cry Freedom, even though I felt that the speech beforehand kind of like perfectly summarized where we were at from a worldview standpoint in 1996, where like, as long as we had like cool faces everywhere, as long as we had people that we like gave shout outs to, like, we were doing enough. And like, there's a very kind of tepid speech in favor of Nelson Mandela before they go into Cry Freedom. But I think it's like it's a really powerful song. I'm a huge sucker for Drive In, Drive Out. And, I think that it just like really showcases Carter Beauford, in a really nice way. Typical Situation, I'm really stoked to hear every time they play that. And I thought the Trippin' Billy's ending was really fascinating. One thing that I'm just like pulling it up right now, because on a few other releases, so it looks like Watchtower gets a one on the show flow, but I've noticed in a few of our earlier releases that we talked about last week that Watchtower was getting docked some points. And I'd really be curious, like, anyone in the audience listening, what your thoughts are on Watchtower, because that was one of the initial draws for me of this band. And it's still like a highlight every time I hear it. It's just, there's so much power to that song. But I'd seen on like our first few episodes that we did that dipped a bit in the show flow. So I don't know if that was just like a one-off, the performances weren't very strong, or if there's a perception in the community that maybe it's overplayed or it's kind of redundant. Brett Wooden just said it's overplayed. I guess that's all it is. It's you can have a great song and you can play it too much. What are your thoughts, RJ, on their take on the most, the heaviest covered song in rock history?
I mean, nothing really.
It's kind of like getting a zero set closer for Fish. That's it. That's it. It was one of those things that like drew me in as like a 13-year-old when I was first getting into Dave Matthews. That was like, oh my God, not only do they cover Watchtower, but they like play it quiet and then it gets really loud. Yeah. And I guess that probably loses its luster over time.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like it. And they're, you know, it's interesting because that song is like, it's really meant to be used sparingly, you know?
You would think.
You know? Well, we got to get into our awards because we got to get people back to their days. I don't know. I'm still like with my family. I don't know if people are working today or if it's like still a holiday or if it's like in between. I can't really tell. I'm sort of confused about.
It's that time of summer where time is just like, you know, it just.
That's true.
Who knows?
That's true. That's definitely part of it for sure. Should we talk about the awards?
We should.
Do you want to go?
I'll go. We've got our bathroom breaks.
Yeah.
Which, to be honest, I kind of struggled over this one compared to episodes last week. I kind of knew where I was going to take my break in previous episodes, or as in the Thursday episode, I wasn't going to take a break at all because the show was so good. This one was Proudest Monkey. It's about 10 minutes. It's not my favorite Dave Matthews song, and that's being complimentary. And I was kind of like, all right, Ants Marching just rocked my world. I'm going to go take a break, and I'm going to come back, and I'll be back in time. I'll probably miss Satellite, and I'll come back in time for Cry Freedom post-speech, and I'll be there for the encore. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good call. I think it's hard. Like, after the long Jimmy thing jam, I think that's, like, a good time to take a break. But the Ants Marching is a nice re kind of like commitment. So I guess I'm probably going at like in the middle of Ants Marching so that I can be back and see what happens next. But I probably should, that's what I would do, but I probably should do the same thing that you're doing. So
I think you let's just go time. Hang out. Let's go get, you know, some food. You can get a beer. I'll get a lemonade and we can make it back to our seats in time for the encore. I'm glad that like my assumptions, Tyler, thank you. Proudest Monkey is always
about nice. You're on it, man.
I also have to say, sorry, really quick. Yeah, I know we're running up against time, but the speech before Proudest Monkey, I'm just remembering it. That to me, it reeks of 1996, like centrism. This idea of I wrote this song because I thought we came from trees and I like that better than the idea that we came from a creator. But now I think about it as like the band's grown. And I was just kind of like, man, like just play the song, like but just play the song. What did you have? Who did you have as the MVP of the show?
I mean, I think it's, you know, I feel like this is becoming a pattern, but I think it's got to be Dave because. To go and put these songs out there and to, you know, have an album release party, I mean, that's fun, but it's also, like you were saying earlier, I think a pretty stressful situation. And I think his singing and some of the kind of structure of the show was really great. And I assume it was a pretty amazing night for them. So I'm going with Dave.
I'm going to pivot from the doc because I initially put Dave, and just to add some color to this, like I agree with everything you just said. I think that like so much of what makes this show successful is his songwriting has reached a level where it's about to hit the zeitgeist of the culture. You know, like this is about to overtake not just the jam community, but this is about to like get to places where there are people who own the Crash CD, and that's the only Dave Matthews CD that they own. And they've never attended a Dave Matthews concert, and they've never even thought about attending a Dead & Co concert, let alone a Fish concert. Like they have never stepped foot in this, and they own the Crash CD. It's one of those records from the 90s that I'm sure it's at a lot of used CD stores. Yeah. Similar to my first CD purchase of all time, which was REM Monster, which is you can probably buy like for 50 cents at a used CD store at this point in time. But I'm going to go with someone who I haven't mentioned and I've tried to avoid mentioning for some pretty sincere reasons. But I think that this is the peak period for this member of Dave Matthews, and that is Boyd Tinsley. Like to me, the least appealing aspect of Dave Matthews shows is the violin solo. We talked about this offline with our good friend Matt Dwyer, who will be a future guest on this show as we dive deeper into the catalog. That said, like, this is the time period where, like, when Boyd rips it up, as he does in, like, Ants Marching, it has a profound effect on the song, and it has a profound effect on the impact that the song has and the show has on the audience. He's all over, like, the Live at Red Rocks release that was recorded about 10 months earlier, and he's all over this. And so if I'm going to give him any sort of a pat on the back, it's going to be at this era of Dave Matthews Band, where, like, the band just sounds like they're not, like, Leroy is not fully taken over the jamming of this band. This is, yeah, can Dave and Boyd connect, and can Boyd throw out a great solo?
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. Okay. All right. We have to talk about the jam.
We do.
And then we're going to let everyone get back to their day. So what's the jam for you?
To me, it's the jam.
Mm-hmm.
The Richmond jam. It's a cool, surprising moment early in the show. You know, I considered two-step just because it's a live tracks debut, but I loved having this, like, moment of improvisation, and, you know, this moment of kind of creativity in a way that kind of shocked me early on. It kind of reminded me of the best parts of the first and third volume that we talked about last week, where mm-hmm. it felt like the band, like, segmented the opening of the show and then played you into the remainder of the show. It was cool. What about you?
I think the Jimmy thing, you know, just like long jam, I think really it, kind of tight, but also, like, pretty cool to hear. So I'm going with the 15 minute Jimmy thing. So Brian, tomorrow we're going to be back again. We're going to be talking about Live Tracks 5, which is from 1995. So we're going back a little bit further, which I think will be fun, because there's some songs on there I think that we haven't heard yet on Live Tracks. And so I'm excited about this conversation tomorrow. We'll be back at 12 o'clock tomorrow for those of you watching, and for those of you listening, thank you for listening and for sharing and for hanging out with us. Anything else we need to say, Brian?
No, I'm really excited about this. This is 8 days after the Red Rocks performance. This is Dave Matthews at, like, a very, very cool period in time. And I've listened to this show. There's some really cool moments. I'm excited to dive into this with you.
All right. Well, then we're going to be back tomorrow at 12. Thank you guys for tuning in. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you all tomorrow.
See y'all soon. Peace.
Osiris.